Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 30337, State v. Atwood. Arguing for the petitioner, David Serrano. Arguing for the respondent, Peter Hanano. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Serrano, you may begin. Mr. Serrano, we
I'm
are
sorry.
Taping this.
I'm sorry, I moved.
I know. Well, try and remember to stay behind the microphone.
I apologize. If one were to agree with the reasoning of the ICA, then if my client, his contract was completed, and my client finished the job because he wasn't fired, and then he was, and everything was okay, and he was then, Mr. Liu called the police and said, I found out he's not a contractor, then according to the ICA, my client's still guilty of theft. And the reason why that happens is because the result was because three issues or questions weren't answered or weren't actually properly answered. Number one, was there proof of an intent to deprive? Number two, did the deception have pecuniary significance? And number three, was there proof that Liu was deprived of anything? The answer to all three of those questions is no. So the first question that we brought up was, on our initial brief to the ICA, was whether or not there was an intent to deprive, which is something that occurs in all theft cases. In fact, not only wasn't there any proof of an intent to deprive, quite to the contrary. Mr. Atwood came to the job, he bid the job, he did work for a number of months, on the job, he completed what he was supposed to complete, and actually he was paid. If you look at the contract and the testimony from the grand jury, except for the first 20%, every time after that he was paid after work was completed. So it's showing that his intent was to fulfill this promise that he had made to build a home. Not because he was or wasn't a contractor, but it was because he had made this promise, and that's what the theft statute's all about. So he was fired then, interestingly enough, not because he wasn't a contractor at all. He was fired because there was a dispute over some plumbing supplies. And it wasn't a situation where he was told, A, you have to buy the supplies, and he says, I don't have any more money. He just refused to know. We don't know why the refusal occurred. But it clearly wasn't a situation where there's any proof that my client had taken the money and couldn't afford to pay for supplies. It was clearly a contractual dispute between owner and builder. So to the question number one, once again, the answer is no. They have not provided any proof that he intended to deprive anybody of anything.
Mr. Serrano, what's the significance of Mr. Atwood's misrepresentation that he was a licensed contractor?
The deception. Number two, and it's important because the deception doesn't have to just be a deception. The deception has to have pecuniary significance. And the pecuniary significance has nothing to do with whether or not he's a contractor at all. The pecuniary significance has to do with what was delivered. If I went to buy a diamond for my wife, and I wanted to buy it from a qualified gemologist, and I bought it from a guy, and he said, this is what this diamond is, and I find out later he's not a qualified gemologist, and I go and have the diamond checked, and the person tells me who is qualified, hey, that's exactly what he sold you. The deception about his qualifications doesn't matter. It's whether or not that diamond.
Is that a good analogy?
I mean, absolutely.
Isn't the better analogy, the homeowner said, look, I would not even have gone into the contract if I knew he wasn't a contractor. Licensed contractor. And so your analogy is the quality of the ring versus whether or not, I think a better analogy might be, would you want that ring put into, you buy the stone, and would you want an unlicensed person putting it into the band? That might be a better analogy.
What I'm trying to say is the pecuniary significance has to do with the product, the result. It doesn't have to do with his qualifications. Because if he built the home appropriately, and there's no evidence he didn't, then what is the theft in this case? There's no pecuniary significance to him being a contractor or not being a contractor. There's a statute for that.
Wasn't there evidence that the subsequent contractor said the work was not well done?
Well,
and some of it had to be done over again?
Well, actually, on page 12 of the grand jury transcript, it says the electrician went through and he did and he found two things. So they're talking about two things that weren't done. He said there were live wires stuffed back in the walls that weren't even capped, and then he referred to something else. But you also have to understand that my client was never allowed to finish the job. He was never allowed to finish the job. He still had 20% of the contract price coming along with the 4.16 GE tax.
Is it your position that the intent to deprive had to exist at the beginning of the contract?
The case law that we cited talks about the beginning of the contract. If there was a point where he was paid up front to do work and he just picked up his stuff and went home or moved to wherever he's going to move to, then that intent to deprive could occur later. But yes, in these cases with these facts, they have to show that when that contract was signed, based on what was presented to the grand jury, that he intended to deprive the owner of something. And there's absolute, and that goes to that third question, which has to do with value. So the intent to deprive can arise after the contract happens, but in this case, based on what they've shown, the intent to deprive would have to be shown when that contract was signed.
Well, that's one of the arguments they make, right? That the intent to deprive, you could infer from the testimony before the grand jury, might have arisen, well, let's say, towards the end of the contract. But could you infer that he never intended to complete this contract because he really wasn't qualified to do the electrician work?
No, I don't think you can. I think it's the only thing you can infer was that he was fired. Not because he wasn't qualified, not because he wasn't doing a good job. He was fired because there was a dispute over some plumbing supplies. That's the only reason why he was fired. They knew a month before the firing that he wasn't a qualified contractor or a licensed contractor. But there is no evidence whatsoever that that wasn't part of the last 20% of finishing the job, and that's how it was paid. It was paid, every portion gets paid as things happen. Now, it appears that there were more than four payments because the person from the DCCA said there were 22 checks issued to my client. But we can presume, based on the way that the contract was laid out in testimony on page 9 of the grand jury, that other than the 20% that was given, he was paid after each portion of the job was complete. So, you know, I don't think you can infer that there was somehow an intent to deprive afterwards, or that he somehow thought, oh, I can't finish the job.
What's the significance of the fact that the complainant needed to pay the subsequent contractor quite a bit of money over and above what he had contracted to pay Mr. Atwood?
Well, first of all, first significance is he fired my client, so he didn't get the benefit because he fired my client. And so he doesn't get benefit of the contract. That's number one. Number two is, if they're saying that that's the theft, this is the first time they've brought it up. They surely haven't brought it up in any argument up until now.
I don't think they're saying that's the theft. I think they're saying that's the value of the services that were lost. Isn't that what they're saying?
Which is the first time that they brought that up. I mean, up until now, the judge who heard this, Judge Bisson, the Intermediate Court of Appeals, the state, they've all said that it's the contract price, which is this $95,000. But how is my client supposed to be responsible for a person who then fires them and hires somebody else who may or may not be qualified? And by the way, the person didn't finish. Read the grand jury transcript, the person didn't finish. And again, is my client responsible for the fact that the person they chose to hire the second time around didn't finish? So, I mean, I don't know if there is any significance to the extra $38,000, I believe it was, that was paid to this mystery contractor.
Well, probable cause is a pretty low standard.
Absolutely.
Whatever his intent was, shouldn't that be decided at trial?
Well, there needs to be, they need to show probable cause for the crime. They have to have some circumstantial evidence to show that there was an intent to deprive by my client, and there's not. Because if they go, and that is completely separate from the whole deception issue, and whether or not the deception had pecuniary significance. So they have to show all of these things before the grand jury, otherwise they don't meet the crime. They meet an act, they meet a breach of contract potentially, but that's all they meet. They can't show he intended to deprive. There's not one action in the entire grand jury transcript that suggests or you can imply that he intended not to finish the work. That he intended to take something that he had contracted to do and not do it. There's not even a situation where they said, oh, you know what? You said you were going to do these things. We'd already paid you for them, and he refused to return the money. There's none of that. It was a turnkey job, which says to me, based on what he's talking about, that everything, including the supplies and everything, were paid up front. Well, as a part of this contract, and there was a dispute over some plumbing supplies. So there's nothing in the evidence that could suggest or possibly be inferred at any level that he had an intent to deprive. And if they don't have that, then they also don't have, well, they don't have that. They don't have the deception with the pecuniary significance. And you know, there's all kinds of hypotheticals. I mean, suppose an attorney, because somebody, when I was talking about this, and somebody said, well, what about lawyers? And I said, well, good example. If a lawyer, the person said, I'm a lawyer, I'm going to do a contract. And it turns out that the contract's fine, it's bulletproof. And it turns out the person's not a lawyer. Is that a theft? No, it's not a theft. It's the unauthorized practice of law. But it's not a theft because that line doesn't have pecuniary significance. Pecuniary significance should be attributed to the product. And not because, and there's other alternatives. That person will probably be prosecuted if reported for unauthorized practice of law. Just like Mr. Atwood in count two of this case is being asked to answer to him doing this type of work without a license. That's not the subject of this of our appeal. That is still back in the circuit court.
What about Dr. Liu's testimony regarding the $16,000 in plumbing supplies?
Where he says, I think that comes down, that came with, okay, had you already paid $16,000 to him for plumbing supplies? We had already paid, yeah, for everything. You know, we had already paid that much. Again, issue isn't a situation where there's any evidence that my client said, I can't afford it. I don't have the money. There was clearly a dispute. My client refused to buy those particular supplies. That's a contract dispute. It's not a theft.
I thought that Mr. Liu gave him the money to buy those contract, that equipment, those goods. And when he went to the store, he found out that he hadn't bought them.
Well, I don't think that's clear in the transcript at all. I don't see that, but.
Well, it's turnkey. That means everything.
Well, I understand that, but it was an interesting question was asked to Mr. Liu. And did he ask you to pay again for the plumbing supplies that you did for this order? Well, basically, we asked him to pay, but he refused to pay, and because of that, we fired him. That's all it was. I mean, there was a dispute. It's not as if he said, oh, yeah, you have to pay again because I don't have the money. That might be a different situation. But again, you can't infer that somehow my client wasn't planning on buying them. He refused. A contractor is talking to somebody who's building their home and is saying, look, I'm not paying for that. We don't know why that happened. We don't know if it was a dispute in the contract, whether the contract, I agree, it was turnkey. But clearly, it wasn't just, according to Dr. Liu, an $89,000 contract, because ultimately he paid about $5,000 more. So there was obviously additions that were made. And what I'm saying is, You can't infer, because my client says, look, I don't want to buy those plumbing supplies, that he's not planning on buying some plumbing supplies or plumbing supplies at all. You know, you can't jump to that conclusion, and there's just no evidence of that. It would require you to reach, or anybody to reach, to make that conclusion. So, finally, the value, which kind of brings us to a Bautista analysis, the state of play versus Bautista analysis. And if you're just looking at this alone, the question is, what is the loss? Because there has to be loss. I mean, it can't be a situation where he gets what he's bargained for, and because they say my client has not told the truth, that there is somehow now a theft. I mean, in Bautista, the court was clear that they have to show some kind of loss, and in fact, they didn't show a loss. They showed that because they fired my client, they needed to pay somebody $38,000, along with supposed maybe plumbing supplies, maybe not plumbing supplies, to not finish their home. But it does not show that what is the worth of what was already built. If the worth of what was already built is hypothetically $150,000, then is there a loss? What's the value of the loss? There is no value to that loss. And that's why I say the pecuniary significance has to do with, if he said, I'm going to build you a home with fireproof wood, I have this special fireproof wood. This doesn't exist.
Isn't there some sort of implication in the record that actually the homeowner got a pretty good price?
There is an implication. The DCCA, I saw that. I didn't know how to bring that out and sound like I was simply just maybe bolstering my case. But the DCCA, the person from the DCCA did say that it was a small job for somebody bigger for this amount of work with what needed to get done and the price equivalent of it. So
I'm actually not talking about that. Doesn't it come out through the testimony of the homeowner when he says something to the effect, he had his daughter's work on this, that's how he was able to keep the price down, which indicates that the homeowner probably got a pretty attractive deal on this whole thing, and it looks as if that's how the price was kept down.
Or the profit was reduced, or however the price was kept down. I mean, I think it's there that he used his daughters. I don't know if that's completely uncommon on Maui, and I know that's not part of the record, but using family to help at job sites is not completely unheard of. It's if what was bargained for, in other words, up until he was fired, was delivered, there's no loss. There's no loss at all. And if there's no loss, there's no theft. Unless you believe what the ICA said and what the state has brought forward, which is, hey, if the contract price, regardless of what was given to this guy, it's the contract price. And it's just that logic, again, would lead to really absurd results for future cases. This is essentially a contract case. This is a case that has to do with the breach of contract. Never was a theft, never should have been a theft. Because he got what he bargained for, and that's what it comes down to. Regardless of who did the work, he got what he bargained for. There was evidence that he didn't get what he bargained for. That may be a different issue, but that's not what we're dealing with in the 22 pages of grand jury transcript that I've reviewed. Based on that, one more thing. Dr. Liu can't take the benefit of this $38,000 if you are going to consider the $38,000 because he chose to fire my client. He just can't take advantage of that. He can't say, I choose to fire somebody. And if my client was licensed and this same thing had happened, then under the theory the state's going on, my client's liable for the $38,000 because he didn't finish the project, and that's the deception. Well, we know that's not true. We know that's a contract dispute. They can go deal with that in another type of action, not in criminal court.
There actually are civil remedies precisely if the person isn't licensed and the job is completed, where they can impose very significant fines, forfeit property, get an injunction, and a series of other remedies.
Well, and actually, the homeowner's in a better, I'm not suggesting everybody should go out and get a non-licensed contractor, but the homeowner's in a better position, because the homeowner, according to the statute, doesn't have to pay the bill. He never has to pay the bill, which draws into a little bit of a question. He says he talked to a bunch of lawyers and said there's nothing you can do about it. Well, it's clear. There is something he can do about it. He didn't have to pay the bill, but he continued to pay the bill. He continued to work with my client, and I think the inference that can be made is because my client was doing a good job, and my client was completing something at a really good price, and then there was a fight, and he decided to fire my client. And in frustration, he reported my client to the police. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Serino.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Peter Alano appearing on behalf of the respondent plaintiff appellee in this case. We're here to basically examine whether or not the Intermediate Court of Appeals committed a grave error in issuing its summary disposition order on May 17, 2012, which basically affirmed the circuit court's order denying petitioner's motion to dismiss. Mr. Serino brings up 3 points that I would like to respond to.
Mr. Hanano,
yes.
Let me get to one of the problems I have. If there isn't evidence of the value of the work that Mr. Atwood did do, how can you prove what amount was wrongfully deprived of Mr. Liu?
Well, I think as the record indicates, there is evidence of what was needed to complete the project, which is $30,000. So basically, you know, the state's position is what was bargained for was, now, aside from the deceit, is a licensed contractor coming to his house, remodeled his bathroom for the contract price. And later on, we find out that he wasn't a licensed contractor. And in fact, he showed other, you know, people's work and represented it as his own. And what we also find out later on is that there were problems with his work. They had to basically rewire whatever he wired. And in doing so, they had to tear down the walls. I mean, basically break open the walls to get it back in there.
The money that he had paid Mr. Atwood was in excess of the contract price by the time he fired Mr. Atwood, wasn't it?
Right.
So there's an implication there that at least the complainant thought that the work was worthy of going over the contract price.
That may be true, but
so
I think
how do we know what the value of the work that he did was?
Again, you know, if you look at what was bargained for and what it took to get Dr. Liu back to what was basically the benefit of the bargain, which is a completed remodeling job by a professional contractor, you know, we can look at how much it would have cost to complete it, which is the $38,000. And at the time that Mr. Liu made these payments, you know, there's no evidence, in fact, there's evidence to the contrary that he even knew that the work was substandard.
Let me ask if the facts were identical, but the defendant was licensed. Would that be theft?
No.
So the entire case is based upon whether he's licensed or not unlicensed.
No, I think the case depends on not only the fact that he was licensed or not licensed, but the fact that he lied about that. There's deception and an intent to deprive. If he said he was licensed and Dr. Liu hired him, I don't think there would be a problem. Or if he said he wasn't licensed, and he said, okay, well, I know you're not licensed, I'm gonna hire you anyway.
So anytime it's an unlicensed contractor, and for some reason there's a contract dispute, or there's a cost overrun, or the contractor realizes that maybe he underbid the project, or whatever happens, it's theft in your view?
No. The difference with that situation and our situation is, in this situation, there's deception.
So if Mr. Atwood represented that he was a licensed contractor, he does the job and it's wonderful and perfect, and it's under the contract price. They couldn't contract for $75,000. It's under the contract price. Afterwards, because he misrepresented that he was a contractor, he could be charged with theft, even though he delivered what was he promised, and it was of good quality.
I understand what your question is, and my response to that would be it wouldn't be a theft one, maybe it would be a theft four, and this is why, because when you contract with someone and that someone tells you that you're a licensed contractor, you know, there's other benefits that come along with being a licensed contractor. You get, you know, as this court has stated, the policy behind you know, having contractors licensed in the state is to protect the public against shoddy, unsafe, and unprofessional workmanship. So there is value, you know, despite what petitioner says, there is value to having someone that's licensed. And you can, you know, have confidence that, you know, they will do a professional job. And it will be safe.
Petitioner says that you have a new statute now that penalizes someone in a criminal sense simply because they don't have they're not licensed. But what I wanted to ask you was, looking at the grand jury transcript, how do we know what the loss was? Presumably, we have to arrive at a sum of $20,000 or over. But all we have is a contract price and the fact that the person or the homeowner had to spend $38,000 more. But what part of that was the theft amount? I mean, we don't know what part of that $38,000 or what the excess was that is attributable to the defendant that amounts to $20,000 or more. There's nothing in the record to indicate.
Right, and I think the reasonable inference is that the $38,000 included what it took to restore the homeowner to what was bargained for in the contract.
How do you then get over the fact that there clearly, apparently, were change orders here?
I don't know if I...
Did you introduce the actual original contract and all the change orders into evidence?
I didn't see that as part of
it. Introduce that to the grand jury?
I'm not sure. From reading the transcript, I don't think that was done. And I don't know why it went beyond the contract price, whether it was for change or otherwise. It's unclear from the record.
Isn't that the problem? We don't know why. The grand jury doesn't know why. We don't know how much the value of the project was. We don't know if he got a good deal. We don't know if the homeowner was asking for more and more add-ons. We don't know. It's just pure speculation. In fact, your response to a couple questions ago when you said that the value of not having a building contractor would be theft four immediately struck me. Well, how do you determine that? I mean, it's the same thing. It seems like it's pure speculation.
Well, in that situation, but as far as the 38,000, that's a number that, you know, is based on, you know, someone actually coming in there and completing the project.
But we don't know what the value of the project, we don't know if there's been any loss at all. You know, the whole bottom line of theft, this is from the commentary, it should be noted that in all theft offenses, the requisite mental state is intent to deprive the owner of the value of property. We don't know if there's been any loss of value. It's completely speculative.
I would have to disagree that it's speculative. I think it's clear from the record that the amount that the homeowner had to pay to get to what was bargained for in the contract was $38,000, which includes part of it is, you know, the second contractor had to go in and fix what the...
How much did the fix for the electrical work cost?
It's not clear in the record.
So we don't know how much of that work was attributable to the defendant.
Right, I agree with that, Justice Apple, but there's no breakdown of what the $38,000 consists of, but what we do know is that's what it took to complete the project.
So if it was under $20,000, then what is the validity of this indictment?
If it wasn't $38,000?
Yes.
And it was less than $20,000?
Yes.
Then it wouldn't be a theft one, obviously.
Okay, so then the indictment would not be valid?
Right. If the second contractor came in and had to pay, and it cost $19,000, It wouldn't amount to a theft.
So what if it was 19,000?
It probably would have been a theft one. You know, assuming a theft two, I'm sorry. Assuming everything is equal.
But we don't know whether it was 19,000 or 25,000.
It's 38,000 based on the testimony.
What if Mr. Atwood was actually licensed until December 31st and he entered, well, he was licensed last year and then he felt he couldn't pay for the licensing fee or the bonding fees or whatever for this year, and then he then entered into the contract this year. And then he had a $100,000 contract, and then the homeowner, and then it, for some reason it went up to $105,000, and the homeowner was unhappy and fired him, and then had to pay $38,000. Would that be theft? Intent to deprive?
Assuming everything else is equal? Probably not, because, you know, what's different in that situation is you don't have the intent to deceive. You know, versus in this case, right off the bat, he says, you know, I'm a licensed contractor, here's my number, turns out it's someone else's number, and then he goes and he shows someone else's work that's not even his. So he knows that I can't show my own work because, you know, I don't know, whatever reason, but here's someone else's professional work that was done, and I'm going to make your bathroom just like that, you know, basically is the inference. And, you know, that's the difference between the situation that you just described versus this one. There's that deceit factor. And, you know, that's my next point is, you know, petitioner argues basically that the deceit can only be proven one way, and that's under 708-800 subsection 5, which states that promises, performance, which the person does not intend to perform or knows will not be performed, but a person's intention not to perform a promise shall not be inferred from the fact alone that the person did not subsequently perform the promise. Okay. The problem with that is there's other sections, and as the ICA correctly noted, you know, he can, which he did in this case, you know, create deception under subsection 1 and 2. And even subsection 5, you know, it doesn't say that you cannot infer deception from just the fact that someone fails to perform a subsequent promise. It's just that fact alone. But in addition to that, we also have creates or confirms another impression, which is false and which the defendant does not believe to be true. He says, I'm a licensed contractor. He knows he's not. Fails to correct a false impression with the, which the person previously has created or confirmed. So he never did come back and say, you know what?
What about Mr. Sereno's argument that there needs to be a connection between the falsehood or deception and the loss? Does there need to be a connection, or can there just be a loss and deception and they don't have to, one doesn't have to cause that?
Well, I think we have both, because if you look at the charge, it's over a period of time. It's not just based on, you know, when the contract was entered into. It's based on a continuing course of conduct from when the contract was entered into and when the defendant was fired. So, you know, you can look at the entire course of time during that charging period and determine whether or not, you know, there's sufficient evidence to support the charges.
At some point in time, however, he found out that he wasn't a qualified or licensed contractor, and he continued to have him work for him and paid him money.
That's correct.
Is it in the record? So wouldn't the only part that, under your theory, that he would be liable for is the amount of money that was paid before he found out he wasn't a licensed contractor? Because he already knew about it once he got the license, right? When he made the subsequent payment.
Right.
So is there evidence of how much money he paid before he found out he wasn't a licensed contractor?
No, there's no evidence on that. But the fact that the homeowner knew or found out that he wasn't a licensed contractor and continued to hire hire the petitioner is irrelevant, because the expectations of the homeowner were still the same. You know, you complete this project.
But the deception wasn't there anymore. And you said that there's a connection between the deception and the amount of loss. Well, that can't be true from the time he found out he wasn't a licensed contractor.
Because the deception already occurred. You know, he already said he was a licensed contractor and he wasn't. So that carries on through you know, throughout the whole charging period. Because you can't change that. I mean, you know, once he found out, once he deceived the homeowner into signing the contract, it's already done.
Well, but there has to be with intent to deprive, deception with intent to deprive.
Right.
Okay. And intent to deprive, the definition is withholding. And withholding means that you're holding on to something that you're not entitled to. And in your scenario, what is being withheld, his intent to deprive, depends on how much it's going to cost to bring somebody else in to finish the job.
Well, he's withholding the money that was given to him, or I guess the value of what he promised to deliver. I mean, that's the only way you can place a value on that.
Okay, so then you should have evidence of what the total contract should have been minus what was actually paid.
I think we need to not look at so much the numbers, you know, aside from the $30,000, but look at what was bargained for.
Okay, so where's that evidence? What was bargained for?
He bargained for a completely turnkey remodeled bathroom by a licensed contractor. Okay, we know that licensed contractor, that's not going to happen already. But he still, you know, he still promised to deliver a turnkey remodel project. So if he didn't do that, then, you know.
Okay, so but the contract actually contained what types of fixtures and plumbing materials would be used?
I'm not sure because that's not part of the record.
For all we know, he may have put more money into that job than he was paid for. We don't know.
It's not clear from the record, you know, but basically what we do have is that the homeowner has to bring in someone to complete the job and fix the problems that the
But that's a different issue. They may have misbudgeted. They may have changed what they had contemplated. There's so many explanations. We don't know if he made 1 cent out of this.
I don't know. I can only speak for what's on the record. And what's on the record is that the homeowner had to pay $38,000 to complete the project that the petitioner did. So basically, I pretty much covered all of my points. So value again, you know, we're relying on the fact that it took the homeowner $38,000 to hire someone to complete the job that was previously bargained for. The other thing is, you know, the fact that petitioner got fired, and you know they're saying now that oh well he could have finished the job if he came back. You know, I think that's not a reasonable position to take based on the fact that you know the wires that were improperly wired in the home were inside the walls. I mean, if he intended to come back and fix the wiring, he would have to break down the walls again, which I don't think reasonable inference as far as him coming back and fixing. So when he put the wires in and finished it with the walls, I think he basically intended that that's the way it was going to be. And
is that in the grand jury transcript that the walls were closed and finished?
Well, it's what's in it is that they had to tear open the walls to fix the wiring.
His daughter's going to have done demolition.
I'm sorry?
His daughters could have done the demolition.
But it doesn't take away from the fact that, you know, the walls have to be torn down either way. And, you know, for him to say, I was going to come back and tear down the walls and fix the wires when I didn't do it right the first time, I think would be, you know, a reasonable inference. So based on the arguments that we presented today as well as in our
That was Dr. Liu's testimony, that it took $38,000 to complete the job as contracted. That was his testimony in the grand jury?
In fact, I think he said, I think the $38,000 was to fix what was not done right, and I don't think the job was even completed. So, but basically, for all intents and purposes, yes, $38,000 to complete and fix what the petitioner did not do correct the first time.
Anything further, Mr. Hanano?
I'm sorry?
Anything further?
That's all I have.
All right. Thank you.
I don't know why to talk about this wiring, but the wiring, just so we're clear, what the transcript says has to do with, did you have the wall cut open and rewired? Yes, yeah. But what they didn't say that it was because it was defective. He just wanted to be sure that, just to make sure that they are safe and to code. There's no indication that they weren't safe and to code. We just know that he went in and rewired. That's what evidence they have. But I think what's interesting is the fact that there is this new law, this unlicensed contractor fraud that we brought up, that wasn't in existence when we first did our briefs. And I think it implies that the legislature recognizes that this type of action is not within the theft statute, because they actually have to say deception, and they actually add a definition. They said if the person says they're a licensed contractor and they're not, that's the deception we're referring to in this particular statute, because it's an otherwise they wouldn't need the new statute. If it was the contract price, they wouldn't have to put that additional language in the new statute, because we can presume that the legislature isn't going to create two statutes for exactly the same conduct. I mean, I think the legislature in passing this new law has all but said that it doesn't, the actions of my client under the circumstances do not fall within the theft statute, and that's why they created this particular statute. So again, the deception has to be related to the pecuniary, it has to have a pecuniary significance, it has to be related to the value. What was produced, was it really a diamond? If it was really a diamond, it doesn't matter his qualifications. So we're going to ask you respectfully to find, to all three of the issues that they weren't proven, and to reverse the ICA's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement.